the full sense of tribe, and you know, it's also community, and where do I belong, and who do I belong to, and where are the people like me? You know, it's a very fundamental kind of urge in human life. And at one level, there's an innocence to it, a normality to it. But of course, it's also a very dangerous urge. And I suppose it's a territory where I think there's an awful lot of naive thinking around. I mean, it's obviously I'm conditioned by the fact I live in Glastonbury. People always talk about looking for their tribe or finding their tribe or having, you know, feeling like they've come to the Glastonbury as the perfect village or something, which, let me tell you, it is not. You know, we have and in one level, one part of it, of course, is to do with the great disconnection that's happened to us all in modern life. But one of the things that sort of gets forgotten in this, those of us who were brought up in very small villages, not all of us, but many of us who are brought in small villages end up desperate to get away from them. Because of the smallness of the world, because of the oppression of the over-closeness and the movement into the city is a relief. It's amazing. That's a relief. Now, you may not stay there. You may be there. I mean, I didn't stay living in the city. I came about, you know, for some years I lived in cities, and then Ali and I just lived in country places, but lived in country places as not as natives. So therefore we're freer. And there's something kind of interesting really that you find, the opposites really of that. Oddly enough, you find it really kind of demonstrated in Geoffrey of Monmouth's Life of Merlin, where Merlin is driven mad by the experience of war, by the experience of how human beings behave to each other, and runs off into the greenwood. And it's fine in the greenwood until winter comes, but then he's on his own in the greenwood and he has nothing to eat, and even his wolf, his companion, is dying, and he's lured back to the city by the image of his wife Gwendolina and the and there's a whole process that happens in the Vita Merlini of Merlin oscillating between the greenwood and the city. Until at the end, what happens is he is his sister Ganida, and he decide to live together, and they build an observatory to look at the stars in the deepest part of the forest. So it's a total paradox. I mean, you build observatories on mountaintops, you don't build them in the deepest part of the forest. But you have a sort of, and there's a whole, we're going to look again at the Vita Merlini next year when we look at really how that he, because in a sense, this is the crossover time for looking at some of the native Welsh traditions, to looking at the medieval legends around Arthur, which Geoffrey of Monmouth is really central, and then we'll go on to Malory and all of that. But the resolution, in a sense, to that sense of nature, people, is you bring the two elements together. You create this structured place where the masculine and the feminine in unity together in a deep place that is also a high place. Now, obviously, it's not a literal place. You can't literally do that. But in a sense, the one of the problems, I think, that we see in our culture in relationship to all these splits is the literalizing and the enacting. rather than taking things back into the heart, back into the center of our experience, and alchemizing our experience. You know, so the great issues that patriarchy poses, the issues also of tribal nationalism, picking your side, you know, it's everywhere. I mean, the great issue of polarization of human life and the absence of kindness. And the, you know, if we're looking on the tree of life, you know, Geburah in the collective tree is now massive. Gedulah is very small. And there's almost no balance at all. You know, and if people make mistakes, they're done, they're cancelled, they're out. You know, there's a real kind of, that sense of absolute judgment. You know, it is now so strong. And in a way, what we're looking at when we look at this work, and we look at both the work of the Kabbalah, and we look at the legends of the Grail and Arthur, we're looking at creating a sense of dynamic balance between the opposites that enable, with one which life then manifests in a balanced way. It's like if you, you know, if you go right back to ancient Egypt, the balance between heat and water. You know, the Egyptian traditions are all about how do you bring things into balance. And there's so much symmetry in Egyptian temples and Egyptian art, because actually it's by creating symmetry that you get the flowering of life. Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's true. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, except at the point of winter when the animals die. So there's a real kind of dilemma, right, where he, and this is why part of the oscillation happens. He's fine while the trees are producing nuts and there's edible fruits and there's as you say, the totem animals are helping him. But there's this moment really where winter comes, and the only animal has left with him is his wolf, and his wolf is dying. And there's a great poem within that about the hardship and impossibility of life, really. But yes, absolutely, he is enchained in the city. But it's that oscillation between the two that then means you have to bring the city and the greenwood together. And that's kind of the mystery here somewhere. Yeah. Right, so let's think about this whole business of let's take an issue like Gaza or Ukraine. Okay, now it's almost impossible to talk about, particularly Gaza. It's almost impossible to talk to people about this without people wanting to find out whether you're on their side or not. Normally, you know, dependent who you're talking to, either the side of Israel or the side of Palestinians in Gaza. And if you're not on their side, there's no communication. What you then get is just vitriol and rage. Now, the whole situation, and that's a sort of enacting. And if we think of the deeply connected nature of things, and if we look at this idea of subcreation and the idea that our thoughts and our intentions and our will is generative, like the divine will is generative. So the energies that our thoughts, our expression in the world, ripples through the world. So if we enact the kind of the, you know, the hatred, some aspects of hatred, and polarization in a certain sense is always about hatred. It's always about destroying something, if it's only Netanyahu or Trump, right? It's about, there's a quality of hatefulness in it. But each act of hatefulness increases the overall charge of hatefulness in the interconnected web and makes it easier for others to hate. There's a really, really, Dame Fortune in her book Cosmic Doctrine, which looks at the laws of the cosmos and how the cosmos works, talks about the idea of the divinity and by contrast, by complement, then human beings, will creating tracks in space that continue to move. And so, so if we imagine that our will, our intention, creates a particular trackway that joins, that is attracted to similar trackways, the more we hate, the easier it is for any of us to hate. Now, to alchemize, I'm not suggesting any of us can actually alchemize a massive thing like Gaza, but to alchemize our part of that is to find a way to be with the complexity of that situation and to have our hearts open to everybody involved in this. Now, you've heard me lots of times, I think, say one of the things that helps me is remembering I don't believe in evil babies. And everybody involved is once a baby. And so no matter how, so therefore I can't believe, let myself believe in an absolute evil, even if people are doing terrible things. And, you know, at times in my life I have worked with people who've done terrible things. I've had to find a way to relate with them, not to collude, but to relate to them and find a way to be present with them. And I don't mean by that to love them in some superficial way. But if you like, we think of love as a spectrum. Well, the first piece of that spectrum is the acknowledgement of their existence, of their right to exist, rather than our desire that they should not exist. And then there's a whole spectrum then of being able to be with somebody up to it, including a sense of being a feeling at one with them. So to alchemize then is to be, instead of enacting the polarization, is to be able to hold in awareness sometimes terrible dilemmas, terrible situations. And mostly people aren't doing that these days. What they're mostly doing is picking a side and going after the other side. I mean, that's one of the really bad effects of social media, because you create these sounding chambers, these little tribal entities, where people all say the same things to each other, so they feel empowered by each other. And what you get is the creation of little mob minds, where they can then go off and do terrible things, or, you know, terrible virtual things, or some, at times, terrible physical things as well. Now, I personally believe that we're in a tipping point, a great tipping point, in which the new energy, in a way, the whole business actually of the sense of the deeper connectedness of the world, the developments in science, the understanding really of interconnectedness is everywhere when you look at it. If we look in botany, what we've learned about how plants communicate, how fungal networks communicate, the climate breakdown is making us really see and understand the interaction between human beings and the climate of the world. So these are things that we've never even known before. and certainly never had to deal with before, and we're not doing a very good job of it, but certainly these are new things that have emerged in human life. And I think there's something, there's a potential for something very new to emerge out of that. But at the same time, there are all these energies of resistance and the emergence of old and separating forms. And certainly when we look at some of those religious traditions we were discussing before the break, they're showing up mostly in their worst form, in their most fundamental, most tribal form. And I include within that things like neo-paganism. Because there's something about picking your side that's become really fundamental and present to people. Well, I think we are. I mean, I think that's the whole point. So when I talk about alchemizing, we are, this place where the outside and the inside mirror each other. The extent to which we're able to be at peace with the opposites within us enables us to be at work with the opposites outside us. If we're constantly in conflict with ourselves, maybe constantly angry with ourselves or some part of ourselves or some part of the world. Actually, what generally happens is it's a great relief to get angry with something outside us rather than have to deal with our own internal tension. So the more we can make peace in our own house, the greater our capacity to make peace in the world. Now, one of the things I think if I think of the side working in the UK, the two places I've most worked outside the country are Israel and South Africa, and so Israel is this place of perpetual warfare, awful. I expected South Africa to be a place of, and South Africa is a very troubled country. I'm not going to suggest South Africa is a perfect place by any means. There's all kinds of corruption and crime and difficulty. But anyone who has any understanding of what the apartheid system was like, the extraordinary capacity of the black community to forgive the white community and to work with them. And obviously, there are some very remarkable people in the African National Congress. There's the obvious people, really, like Mandela and Archbishop Tutu, but there are many others who absolutely stretched out hands of friendship to members of the old Afrikaner regime, who themselves had to reach out their hands in response, and so something really remarkable happened in South Africa, and then if you ever spent time there on the land of South Africa, it's a land that's been driven by all kinds of wars. I mean, I spend most of the time with friends of mine up in the Buddhist Retreat Center, up towards the country at the top of the world. I mean KwaZulu-Natal, but it's near towards that country that's like a plateau, small country. Matter, but yeah, but I, but anyway, I spend most of my time in KwaZulu, in the Drakensberg Mountains. The one time we was populated by the Bushmen, but the Bushmen were driven out by the Zulus, who in their turn were impressed by the Boers and then the English, and so it's a land that has lots of wars, lots of energies of old traumas inside it, and still a lot of problems really, but extraordinarily, you know, it did not boil down into some terrible war. And in a way that partly is due to the work that the leaders of the African National Congress did when they were locked up in Robben's Island, and worked on themselves and worked on their understanding of life, and were then able to hold their communities. Hold the communities back in a certain sense from their seeking what God knows, you know, you'd have to say would be a justified form of revenge, if you know anything about what the apartheid regime did to people. No, it's a whole coterie of people. Well, Mandela is obviously the obvious one, he's the leader, but in a way there's a whole load of them there at Robben Island, right, who are the, because they basically locked up all the leadership of the African National Congress, really. And of course they were locked up for years, and Mandela, when he went in, was direct action warrior, really. You know, he wasn't the man of peace he later became. But you know, remarkable really, and there's something remarkable about, if you like, that act of internal alchemy that those guys did, which, but it needed that, that reflection. Now in some ways, if you were to ask me about Israel, which of course is a country I know much better because I spent a lot more time there, as a culture, they are absolutely hellishly traumatized by the Holocaust, unable to process. You know, the one of the things that certainly somebody working with people, I wrote to all kinds of Israelis, all kinds, you know, both peaceniks and warmongers and every shade in between, and you know, it's a small country, but it's not just the Holocaust. Actually, it's even the multitude of pogroms, not just in Europe, also in Arab countries, and so they're a collectively mad culture. And I don't know. Of course, I don't know what the answer to it is, and none of us do. But I think the sense of, and certainly not saying, oh, poor them, they just need understanding. They absolutely fucking well need stopping. I mean, it's appalling what's going on. And the demonization of the Israelis is just another twist of the spiral. Demonization of the Arabs, even the demonization of Hamas, is another twist in the spiral. And in a sense, you know, this takes me right really into the subject of my book, The Tree of Life and Death, which is about the nature of evil and the working with what the Kabbalists call the klipot, the shells, the energies that distort life, that rob life, that twist life, that bend life. Now, our common way of doing it is to banish it, to send it away, to try and kill it, to destroy it. Whereas in the Kabbalah, the deep practice of working with the klipot is to bring it into the heart. To do it skillfully and proportionately, so our hearts are not overwhelmed by the klipotic energies. But as they are brought back into the heart, as they are brought back into the bundle of the living, they are transformed. But in order to do that, we ourselves must be connected to this much bigger field of light and life. Because we do it not in our, if you like, our sense of ego, our sense of self, but as in the service of the divine. And it is the divine that actually really brings all beings back into itself, back whoever they are, whatever they have done. It's that sense of the, but that sense of the profound, both the clarity, right? So it's not about, oh well, doesn't matter, never mind, never mind, you've been a mass murderer. It's also about having to see, to know, to understand that, and to be loved as well as that. You know, so there's a, so in a way, you know, that whole book I wrote is all about the different ways that we can explore that, both within ourselves and in the world. And, you know, certainly 20 years of working, or 17 years, however long it was, working in Jerusalem, meant that I found myself doing a lot of that in all kinds of different ways, both with individuals and with the subtle energies that you find at work in Jerusalem. But it's not just Jerusalem, it's everywhere. Well, you know, it's our own town, our own village, our own country. You know, so there's... So in a certain sense, really, the question here in these times is, well, how can we live in disturbed times? How can we bring light and blessing? How can we hold that stance without dissociating, without pretending the world is other than it is? How can we remember the beauty of the world? And how can we enable that beauty of the world to be effective? Well, that's one of the interesting things. So obviously there's lots of ways to do this. The Tree of Life is one way. Now the archetypal stories are another way. You know, so methods of the Tree of Life can really help us with working with the working with some of the great narratives. And if we think of the root narrative of the Arthurian narrative, what we're looking at is the idea that the world has gone to hell, is in total chaos. And from out of that chaos, a mysterious young person appears who is sovereign and establishes order, establishes justice, establishes balance. And then from that balanced place, there is the search for the sacred, to live amongst human beings, the idea of the quest for the grail. And in a certain sense, I think as we were talking about this, Rob, the Arthurian legends, all these vast sprawling legends, all these different knights. Well, Arthur seems to sit at home. Well, in a certain sense, Arthur having become the sovereign being, then the knights in a way are aspects of Arthur, and each quest is a particular journey, a particular reclaiming of some aspect of the world. And generally speaking, one of the things you find in the Arthurian legends is there's an interaction all the time between the masculine and the feminine. And the And one of the great one of the great legends about the small story, but it's really a massive story about the Arthurian tradition is called the Elucidation, means the elucidation of the Grail story, which says that one time in the world the world was fertile and it was fertile because of the fairy maidens who tended the wells of hospitality and nourishment, and these magical women would receive anybody who came to them and would give them to drink and would look after the land. But an evil king called Amangons and his men sort of decided that, and the maidens would have these magical chalices through which they would offer elixir to people that would heal wounds, that would nourish people, and that would enable things to grow. But in the story, an evil king, Amangons, and his family decide to take the chalices and to rape the Grail Maidens and to seize the Grail Maidens for themselves. As a result of which, the life of the wells dry up, the chalices vanish, and the land becomes the wasted land, the land without health and vigor. Yeah, that's exactly right. It's completely like that, and in that sense, then the things wither. It's out of that dynamic balance, really, between the masculine and the feminine, the inner world and the outer world, that enables the flourishing of the world. I think one of the challenges of Gaza is for all of us it poses an enormous challenge to the heart. How can we be with Gaza? How can we be with the suffering of people in Gaza without hating and wanting to kill the people who are killing the Palestinians of Gaza? Without wanting to say that Netanyahu has no right to exist. The Israeli cabinet should not exist. So I think that immensely stretches our capacity of heart. And if we notice that, I mean, it's clear, you know, it's just clear that what's going on in Gaza is terrible. And if you say to somebody, I think one of my old students I was having a dialogue with, I said, look, it's just terrible. She, with total passion and anger, would say, What about the people that were killed on October the 7th? What about the rockets that rained down in the street next to my house? What about the fact I can't live in my house because Hezbollah are constantly bombing my area? So, she's not wrong. She's not right, but she's not wrong. And in a way, one of the things, it's absolutely worse now, but I've met this over many years. And the ones, so I don't know an answer to Gaza, no one knows an answer to Gaza, but or Israel-Palestine. But I know that choosing a side is not an answer. By which I don't mean that the people shouldn't protest, but it means that protesting, or even at much more subtle levels actually, that kind of ability to to be with an impossible situation and to stay present in it without dissociating, without becoming numb to it, and without choosing choosing a side, is, in I believe, is an effective form of subtle action. The more we're able to do that, the more we're able to hold the whole situation in our heart, the more we increase the possibility for those whose task it is to work out solutions to this, to be able to do that. The more we add to the polarization, the more difficult we make it for those who have the possibility to actually act effectively in that situation. Most of us can't act effectively in that situation. We're far away, we have no influence upon it. But but this is the whole point, really, this whole idea of co-creation. We take seriously that our thoughts, our intentions, our prayers are part of the great interconnected web. How we think, how we pray, how we hold the situation has effect upon it. So we can either make that situation easier by having the capacity to hold those opposites and invite the divine presence to hold everybody, or by choosing a side, we increase and make more difficult the task of those who are trying to resolve it. Well, I think it's why hope is crucial. Hope is a really important energy, and hope is an aspect of imagination. When we lose, the thing about hopelessness, if we lose hope, now hope is a quality that needs cultivating. If we lose hope, our imagination becomes confined into dystopian kind of images. I agree, it's very hard to imagine hope for Gaza. It's the second: faith, hope, and charity. Right. So it's the third. It's the second of the cardinal virtues. So faith. So to have faith is part of it. To have faith in the presence of the divine, in the activity of the divine, the substantiality in the divine, and then the hope. And this is what Tolkien would talk about when he talks about eucatastrophe, the belief against the rational thought that actually somewhere there will be a happy outcome, a good outcome. Now, it's not something, my friend David talks about fiery hope, which I think is a nice phrase, because it's not a oh dear hope. It is that fiery kind of vision almost, that actually people can put down their souls, that people can find common cause, that, or at very least, if they can't find common cause, they can stop trying to kill each other. My hope in Gaza is founded on, you know, a lot of time spending time with both Israelis and Arabs, and in the end they're just people. And I've met terrible people on both sides. I've met amazing people on both sides, and you're right about the mutual traumas, Holly, and the way those traumas trigger each other. But I do believe, and I have hope, that people are bigger than trauma. There's something larger that can hold things. But the other issue that has always been there for that part of the world is the way in which the collective imagination and the collective will of the world looks to that part of the world as the holy land, the sacred land, and asks them to bear the weight of the world working out its problems. And so the extent to which we can hold both ends of the spectrum and not ask them to hold the whole issue of polarization for us is an extent to which we can help. And having hope then becomes a duty. I mean, No. No, I mean, no, of course, not can I. I mean, there's no time, when I say aspect of imagination, I don't mean that we could tangibly imagine how that would be. It really is a profound work of unknowing. Yes, but that is maybe a bit too forward, right, in that sense, because actually if you look at that doesn't work. if you see that trying to work, it doesn't work, because the things are too polarized even for that. So it's much more the capacity to hold both, all really, in the heart, not to know the solution, but to hold them with goodwill and to hold for them the hope that things will resolve. And not to know that, but to hold the intention that this will resolve, this will change. We don't know when, we don't know how.